What do you think it means to be a person?
I don't know.
Me either, really.
Go.
No. Say scratch that again.
Scratch that a fan.
I'm Caitlin Metz, a non-binary illustrator and designer.
I'm Rebecca Tossig, a disabled storyteller and writer.
And this is Scratch That, Parenting and Reparenting Off Script.
A podcast for people trying to parent and person at the same time.
Head over to our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast, for show notes and a transcript of today's episode. And also to join the conversation.
Thank you for being here. Today we get to talk to one of our most favorite humans on the planet. And actually, something that I say often, because it is true, is that I do not think that my son Otto would exist if I had not found Alex on the internet. Sorry, no pressure for the responsibility of a human in the world. But I literally don't think that I would have felt like I could take the leap of imagining myself as a parent if I hadn't seen Alex as a parent. I'm like, I have goosebumps remembering, like finding your account and looking through your pictures and all of these images that just made motherhood and wheelchairs seem completely ordinary and human. And I remember, I think I found you when Asa was a baby. And so I remember all these pictures of him like draped over your lap and like kissing you from his high chair. I remember posts where you were like painted Arwen's fingernails and then like laughed about your quad hands. Just like the warmth and humanness of that felt meaningful to me. But it was not just the images, although I think that's important. It wasn't just the images of wheelchair, baby, mother, parent things. I think it was also like the way that you talked and talk about parenting in this way that made it feel real, like you didn't gloss over any bump or crevice of it, but that you like bore witness to it in this really layered way. And as I was looking back through your Instagram page, this page that I found like five or six years ago now, I found the post that I read the day that I found out I was pregnant with Otto. And I was hoping you would be able to read it for us. I texted you the screenshots. So if you feel comfy with it, would you read that post for us?
Yes, I will read that post for you. She's quick, a lot quicker than me. That's not saying much. I am very seriously considering getting a sloth tattoo. But most humans are too polite to express annoyance at my slowness. Some of them even appreciate it. I have a dear friend who moves at the speed of light all the time, and she often remarks on how my vacation speed is a perfect little interlude. But not the aptly named Lightning. She's fast and impatient, and she has no problem howling, "Hurry up, Mom!" She doesn't know I literally can't move faster, unless it's raining and I'm about to get soaked, and then I get quad super speed, but I don't know how to engage in it in any other context. I don't think she'd care anyway. She's three, and the world dances around her with streamers and confetti, declaring its dedication to her satisfaction at all times, as far as she's concerned. My parents taught me never to rush. My safety isn't worth getting there sooner or getting it done faster. My dad even told a guy I dated in college that the most important thing he could do for me was to not rush me. I'm a people pleaser and don't like to feel like a burden. So if he had asked me to, I would have. My dad knew that. And he knew I'd fall and wind up with a broken wrist or something. Lightning is as resourceful as she is fast and impatient. She yells for me to help her with the things faster, gets impatient, and then she does it herself. I could wander down the rabbit hole of feeling like an inadequate parent because I can't keep up with my three-year-old and am by default forcing independence upon her, but I don't bother. Do you know how much work having an independent kid eliminates? Frankly, I'm glad I'm so freaking slow. While I do think my girl has a little more intrinsic motivation to do things herself than might be typical, kids are capable of so much. They want to do things independently, but in a lot of cases, the roles are the reverse of my family's. Parent friends, I invite you to the dark side. Slow down. Pretend you can't possibly get there fast enough. Parent like a disabled person. Bet you never aspired to that before.
Thank you for reading that, Alex.
I'd forgotten I wrote that. So thanks for inviting me to read it.
I remember that line specifically, like parent like a disabled person.
I remember being in my bathroom. I think I was sitting on the toilet when I read that and just thinking like, oh, that's like a way of looking at the world. This is a shift in what we, how we like evaluate parenting skill, or, you know, it's such a different slant to it. How did it feel reading it now? I mean, that was like 5 years ago.
It felt great. Glad I wrote that. What it conjured for me right now is I had a really frustrating experience a couple of days ago with another parent that flies directly in the face of what I wrote about here. And it didn't occur to me that I had like put so much thought into this topic in the past when I was having an absolute like inadequacy meltdown. So that's really interesting. And like I'll just give you the example really quick. I have some very, very, very close friends who live locally, and we've kind of blended our families together. And one of the challenges of that for me is that the kids in the other families have been parented by like kind of, I wouldn't call them helicopter parents. They're not helicopter parents, but they're parents who jump in and do a lot of things for their kids, often for the sake of their own time. And so in order for me to effectively do childcare, we have to kind of retrain these kids to be a little bit more self-sufficient and respond to instructions and descriptions of like where the thing is, because I'm not going to get it for you, like that kind of thing. And I was at this friend's house the other day, and I've been working with his four-year-old on following instructions. And so I had made him popcorn earlier and poured some into a bowl. And then he wanted more. And I was sitting on the floor in the living room stretching. And so I was like, well, yeah, you're welcome to have more popcorn. I need you to go get the bag off the counter and bring me your bowl and I'll pour it for you. Another adult there who isn't normally around, who doesn't know me very well. And they jumped in and interrupted the interaction. And they were like, oh, no, I got it, sweetie. I'll take care of it for you. And like all of my energy just like sank to the floor. And I was like, this is a kid that I need to be able to parent effectively. This is an important bond between me and this kid. Like the way that other person jumped into it, they had no idea that they were interfering in something really important. And they were, and it like ruined my day. Yeah, it was a really hard emotional experience. And I had to like debrief on it later on. So that's kind of what that brings up for me is like, oh, interesting. I can put that out into the world and it can really resonate for people. But a lot of the time folks aren't thinking about this stuff at all.
That moment that you described with that, I'll get it for you, sweetie. I think like my whole inside felt like it turned into like volcanic ash, just like, wah. I've had so many moments like that, Alex, where it's just like this swift interruption of the dynamic that I am trying to build with my son, and like not on purpose, but like this dismissiveness of this like whole framework that we're building. And the like, I don't know how to put language to this, but sort of the assumption that this is better, like it's better for me to like give you this popcorn, sweetie. It's like a better thing to do than just like have you get it yourself. And I think that that speaks to the default that is so intrinsic, or that seems so built into how people often interact with kids. And so what you are building, and kind of I hope what I'm building with my son, is like disruptive to that instinct.
It is, and it's not natural for the other adults around. For me, also the interruption, I just like on a personal note, the interruption that involved like a pet name with a kid that they weren't actually that close with felt condescending to me. Like I know for a fact it wasn't, but my hackles went up. I was like, are you directing that at me? Like I'm not being like enough of a caregiver here. It really like hit me hard.
I felt that word too. And I don't want to be too critical of this person because I know that none of that is with malice, but like the sweetie part is like, I'm softer and more affectionate somehow.
It felt to me like this person felt like they were rescuing the kid from like my version of parenting him, and using a term of endearment in that just made it sound more syrupy. I don't know. I'm petty. So there's that.
Me too, apparently, because I felt the edge of that too. So like before we dive into like talking more about parenting stuff, we would love to hear a little bit more about little Alex, young Alex, and the world that you grew up in. So would you be able to tell us a little bit about like who were your teachers when you were young? When you looked out into the world, what were the guides or teachers around you?
I'm unique in that I have a congenital disability. I was injured at birth, and my mom is a congenital amputee, probably amniotic band syndrome. Nobody really knows. So I was raised by a visibly physically disabled parent, though our disabilities are super different. And she obviously needs to adapt far less than I do. So in a lot of practical ways, it was my mom, even though I wouldn't say our like mother-daughter dynamic was particularly close or traditional. I still had this like, in that way, she almost felt like a peer, which was really interesting. And I'm much more outgoing and extroverted than she is. And so there, you know, I was watching my very shy, introverted, disabled mom, who's also super capable and independent. And it was an interesting kind of combination of traits that I don't necessarily share all of. So I think that taught me right off the bat that like disability isn't homogenous. Like whether or not I internalized it that way as a kid or not, for sure, that propelled me into interest in understanding what different versions of disability look and feel like. And I've really worked hard to surround myself with disabled people in my like real life. Social media has expanded that dramatically, and I've gotten to meet like so many more people and several of them in person. But even prior to that, like my mom knew it was important for me to be active and in sports and stuff. And so my family's super athletic. I'm a quad. I'm just not. We always joke, like, if she wasn't a quad, would she be athletic? Probably. Like, I have the interest.
You were like in like sports teams and stuff, like wheelchair basketball, or was it?
Yeah, but I went for the socializing and the crushes and and the weekend trips in a 15-passenger van. And the other thing, it wasn't just sports teams. It was tons and tons of like sports camps and day camps and like social activities that were specifically meant for physically disabled kids. The Twin Cities is where I grew up, Minneapolis, St. Paul. And there's just so much there, and there has been for a long time. So I was very lucky. And I had a good range of like the kids that I hung out with were a really big range of ages. There were kids like, you know, several years younger than me all the way up to like 10 years older than me at any given time. So it was really interesting to see people at lots of different phases of life.
Yeah. I'm really jealous of that.
I didn't realize how rare and fortunate that was because many of us there. Yeah.
So do you feel like those experiences were like shaping a map of your perception of yourself, like as a disabled person in a lot of ways? That's how I picture it, as sort of like being able to see people in the world that would contribute towards like combating shame that seems kind of common with disabled folks. Or is that not how it worked out?
I have never felt apologetic or shame or embarrassment about being disabled at all. If anything, I feel like a little obstinate that anyone would expect me to. Like, no. I have not had a terribly difficult time taking up space as a disabled person. I have a hard time taking up space in general as a person. But when it's my access and inclusion and opportunity that's at stake, I have no problem at all. Talk to me in like interpersonal relationships and it's different. But I don't feel any sense of like smallness around disabled. That didn't actually even occur to me until I was out of college, or like maybe partway through college, when I started running into people who, like, I wasn't a cute little kid anymore. I was a grown up now. And so I was getting more of the like, I'm annoyed by your needs kind of thing from the world, from work environments and things like that. And even, I mean, I worked in retail. I had customers who refused to work with me because I was in a wheelchair, like overtly, and they were supported by my employer. Like the employer gave them someone else to work with when that happened. It happened to me twice. If things like that started, and interfacing with the public world outside of my bubbles of like high school and college, you know, being out in normal public, all of a sudden I was having interactions with people that just, I was like, oh, this is how people see me. I wasn't aware of it before that. And then I really withdrew and got really angry for a while, and threw all of my energy into really loud advocacy, which was important for me to do for a while, but it's not really my modality of like making change, I don't think. Yeah, so it was a little bit of a different path, I think, than a lot of people who grew up disabled take. And I also, because I played wheelchair basketball, a lot of those kids had spinal cord injuries that came when they were, after they had learned to walk and had been like considered like typical kids prior to that. So I was socializing with kids who hadn't necessarily been like funneled through the disabled from birth system, which is a very, very different experience than getting injured So I had an interesting like mix of groups of people influencing me.
Yeah. Well, and I said 2 minutes ago or whatever, I said it's so common for people with disabilities to feel shame. I did. I don't know. I don't have like a graph to say how common or uncommon it is. I definitely did. And I do wonder if like the world that you were surrounded with, your mom and then all these other people like on your teams and at your camps, if seeing people take up space with their disabilities is part of what gave you that picture early on, it would make sense to me. I think that's a beautiful way to think about it. So I don't want to like put that blanket on a whole dynamic community of people, but that was definitely the experience for me.
I mean, if my direct messages are any indication, I don't think you're alone. I have a lot of messages from people, mostly disabled since birth or since they were really little, who just don't have the experience with like that kind of community or camaraderie. And I guess maybe one of the things for me that came out of having that is my self-esteem's never been particularly high. I really struggle with feeling like I'm not liked or like I'm not going to be liked. And I could point to a million reasons why, but it never occurred to me, and it still usually doesn't, that my disability plays any part in that. Like, I assume if people don't like me, it's my personality.
For good or bad, I guess. I mean, like, I don't know which script feels more helpful, you know?
I think, honestly, that one's more common, right? So people can relate to me on that. But what I get are direct messages from people who assume that that social anxiety that I talk about sometimes publicly comes from my disability. And how did I overcome that? And I have to sometimes have like a corrective conversation and be like, actually, it has nothing to do with me being disabled. If anything, I think people who choose to spend time with me, like regardless of my like level of ability or disability, like they're the least likely to have a problem with that. It's going to be like, I said something stupid or I talked too much to them.
That is relatable though. But you know what I love about that though, is that I have found that often in the world at large, when there is any sort of problem or like an anxiety or something that feels depressing or hopeless, it's so common for people to pull that feeling into disability or make that about disability. I think that's really common. I mean, I see that with parenting too, like just that whole narrative that like whatever the thing is that's different, it's because of this wheelchair, or it's because of this disability, as opposed to being like, oh no, the disability thing is over here. And then here's this separate thing, whether it, like my kid is walking a tad bit later or I have this anxiety or whatever.
I mean, it's projection. And so often when I talk about mental health or anxiety or self-esteem, what gets projected back to me, both from other disabled people who actually do feel that as a result of their disability and from non-disabled people who assume that all of my emotional problems are because I'm disabled.
Yes.
No, they're actually because of trauma.
Yes, but it's so interesting that that becomes the thing that blankets every, like as if you couldn't have any other problems or any other traumas or triggers or, you know, like it has to be about this one thing.
Become like one dimensional, right? And it's, I mean, that's similar to my experiences and I think also yours in the medical world. Like I go in with a migraine and they're like, well, your quality of life sucks anyways.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, like literally. Yeah.
So I think that's a pretty like broad projection that we absorb as a community pretty easily. Like it's a narrative that people buy into, I think, because they're told that their lives are probably harder and probably less valuable because they're disabled and they take that on. I just, for whatever reason, that's just never stuck for me. I also don't feel mom guilt like ever under any circumstances. And that's another one that I don't know why. I'm just not susceptible to that kind of stuff. I have plenty of other torture happening in my brain, but those are not the thing. I feel no guilt about anything with my kids. I feel sadness when I, you know, break their trust or I'm disappointed in the way that I interact with them and I, you know, repair and things like that. But like the millennial mom guilt thing is not a factor for me. And maybe being disabled and being like kind of adversarial about the idea that I should feel anything but fine about my identity in that. Maybe I'm able to bring that into parenting too. I'm not sure.
That's an asset. That seems like a special little bonus gift. I would like to channel that somehow.
I would like you to channel that, Rebecca.
Oh, I feel guilty about everything. I feel guilty about everything. And then I try to remedy it or fix it. And then I feel guilty about the way that I try to fix it. I'm just like, It's a real punishing cycle up in here. Okay, so we're talking about scripts. We're talking about the way the map that you're building in your brain as you're growing up and how you're piecing these things together. So how would you describe the script that you feel like you were given initially of what a parent is or a mother or a caregiver? What were those initial scripts that you received before, you know, like as a little tiny Alex?
They were kind of confusing. I grew up evangelical, free, capital E, capital F. It's its own denomination. And so the messages I was getting there were predictably trad wifey. My family didn't function that way, but they weren't particularly healthy either, but didn't function in that way. My mom didn't like cook at all. And my dad did most of the cleaning, and my grandma really was like my primary caregiver. So what I was getting from church was I was being prescribed a lot of things I knew I would never be able to do. Like, I'm not going to be able to take care of a home by myself and have dinner on the table for a husband when he gets home promptly at 6:15. And I was also being told pretty regularly by doctors, kind of flippantly, like that I shouldn't have kids, which is just like a weird thing to be saying to like an 8-year-old.
Did it start when you were 8?
Yeah, when I was pretty young. Maybe not 8, I don't know, but it was very young. It was like before I hit puberty, it was like when all the other little girls were playing with their dolls and talking about being mommies. That was never a game for me. I never played mommy.
What kinds of things would your doctor say to you when you were young?
It was always in passing conversation when they'd talk about things like transitioning out of high school and stuff. Like, you know, those long-term like transition plans and things like I talked about in IEP meetings and doctor's appointments. There would just be like flippant comments about, yeah, probably not a good idea, or yeah, I don't know how you would manage that, or whatever. And I mean, even up to the point I already had a kid, like after Arwen was born, I got pregnant with twins like a year and a half after she was born. And then I miscarried, and it was a really traumatic miscarriage at the end of it was a full trimester. It was awful. And I was in her pediatrician's office, and her pediatrician said, it's probably for the best. I don't know how you would have managed twins anyway. Like I started getting those like little opinions as a little kid, and it continued all the way after I had already proven that I could freaking do it.
It shouldn't be breathtaking, but that is like breathtaking to me that people feel so confident in throwing those kinds of things around.
Yeah. So I never saw her again.
Yeah. Yeah. No, thank you.
No, thank you.
It's very interesting to me, the things the doctors say.
Yeah. So I think maybe the boldest line was, it was not for me. Like, it wasn't something that was in my future. It was not on the map for me. I talked a lot about adoption and like adopting older kids someday. And grew up in even the evangelical world where, you know, international adoption is like a thing to do. And so I was like, well, I know I love kids. Like, I loved, as I got older, you know, obviously at 8, I didn't know that I loved working with kids. But when I got older, as like a teenager and in college, I continued working with my youth group and doing like volunteering with like wheelchair sports stuff for younger kids, and worked at camps and stuff because I freaking love kids. I think they're amazing. I never felt grief though or anything, because I had decided that what I wanted was to either not have kids or to adopt them, which I'm good at doing. Like when I know something an option for me, I'm really good at like buying into the thing that is the option. So I think primarily what I thought was, just like anything else I do, it was going to be like very, very different from the way other people do it. My access to it was going to be different, and my entrance into it was going to be different, and I was going to probably not be very good at it. That's probably.
Wow. You like, because you had these words spoken over you that like, you shouldn't do this thing, even though you had the desire, it was the sort of this assumption that you wouldn't be good at it.
Yeah, I was just accepting that it was another thing that I wish I could have that I'll not have, because there's, you know, any disabled person experiences, I mean, people experience that, right? But disabled people experience it on a different level, because you're looking around at other like very typical people going like, that's so cavalierly in their reach. So you just, I don't know, there's coping that's involved in just kind of like shutting down any kind of like interest or longing for something that you.
Yeah, that's very relatable to me. I think I didn't know really that if I want, I just didn't even know what my desire was because it's like not an option. So clearly that changed somewhere along the line. How would you describe how that shifted? And I don't know if that's something you can pinpoint or if it's a slow evolution or how you think about it, but it changed. And how do we think about that change?
Well, I'm bad at taking birth control. That's how it shifted.
Okay. That's pretty clear.
And then I just had to like plug my ears and close my eyes and figure it out. And it was like just a lot of like, My pregnancy with Arwen was like an intense metamorphosis on that front. Cause all of a sudden I was like, I spent my entire life being like, I'm never going bungee jumping, never doing it, never doing it. And now I am at the top of a cliff with a rope tied around my ankle and someone is like about to shove me off and there's nothing I can do to stop it. So I just had to figure it out. I had a lot of feelings, really big feelings around once I got a good OB, which didn't take very long. It was actually relatively easy for me to get an OB who looked at me and was like, there's no reason that you can't have a healthy, easy-ish pregnancy. Like, I don't know why anyone has said otherwise.
Can I ask, was that OB a specialist in it? Like a high risk? Just like a regular OB? Okay.
No, when I got a positive pregnancy test, I was so sick for like 4 days. I thought I had the flu. I hadn't been able to like keep any liquids down or anything. And Brian took me to the emergency room. And then they did a pregnancy test and forgot to give me the results while I was at the hospital. So they told me I had a bug and gave me Zofran and liquids and said I should turn the corner tomorrow or something. And then I got a call like 3 hours after I got home from the doctor who was like, it doesn't look like you were notified you're pregnant. So it was shocking at every turn. It was a surprise. And then I went to my GP, who is not any kind of specialist. I worked at Apple. I went to the Apple Wellness Center. It's just like a standard family doctor. She referred me to the OB clinic she liked. And I just like took the first person that was available. And she happened to be totally unimpressed by me being disabled. Like she just was like, you know, I'm sitting in front of her at her desk and she's like, are you wanting to keep this pregnancy? And I was like, can I? can I keep it? Can I keep it?
Oh, wow.
Literally no reason, like reason in terms of your body that you can't keep this pregnancy. And I was like, what? So then I was mad. Then I was like, I've lied to my entire life and what I got to imagine for myself. And I was just starting to become familiar with the idea that when you don't see yourself represented, you can't imagine yourself in the future. I still can't imagine myself after like age 50 or something because I just don't see people like me. So in my mind, like my lifespan's just not very long, right? But also in my mind, I wasn't having any kids because I just didn't see it. And so I was angry and I was confused and feeling like kind of betrayed by the system of people that were supposed to be looking out for my best interest and helping me like, figure life out. And then I got a doula who asked me to do some journaling. And I have like this kind of manifesto that's like, this is what I have to prove throughout this pregnancy and like, screw all those assholes.
I'm just thinking about the contrast between all of these flippant, I'm assuming kind of like flippant scripts that people are throwing out onto you of like, probably not in your future. And you wouldn't probably be very good at that. Just like this thoughtless script throwing. And then I'm thinking about a doula who just like gives you a blank page to write on and like the invitation to fill it with what you desire and want. And the contrast of that feels so stark to me.
It was a really strange experience. I was so confused. I didn't know what I was or why or what to even really think.
Do you remember any of like what kinds of things you wrote in it?
Generally speaking, I was feeling really offended that my body had been so underestimated and felt a lot of feelings of grief around like what else has been underestimated to the point that I didn't even try, that I didn't even like give it a go because I just believed the people that told me that I couldn't. And I do have a very slothy body. It is difficult to use. I get hurt easily. I've broken my kneecaps and my feet and my like both of my wrists and like I fall really easy. And it's like, so I don't I'm not risk averse necessarily, but when someone with confidence is like, this is a bad idea, you shouldn't do this because you could get injured, I want to stay alive. So I don't do this stuff.
Well, especially if those people are like, have the title of doctor.
Expert, right?
Yeah, expert. Yeah.
Expert. And I hadn't found experts at that point who were teaching me how to gauge my own sense of self or abilities or anything like that. And so I was, you know, it's real hard to like, spinal cord injury is crazy. It's all over the place. I have a C6-7 spinal cord injury, but at one point I could walk a mile unassisted. It makes no sense at all. And so for a doctor to just look at me and be like, well, you have a C-level injury. And also, by the way, a C-level injury doesn't mean you can't have a safe pregnancy. So whatever. But even for them to like, even if that was generally kind of true, for them to look at any individual and just jump to that is, I mean, they did me a lot of harm, right? Like playing God, essentially, really messing with the trajectory of my life. And so I was really angry. I wrote a lot about the anger that I felt in regards to how I didn't trust my body because that was something other people had imbued. I was just doing what I was supposed to do, I thought. And it was my birth plan. I wanted to do it med-free because everybody thinks they want to do it med-free. And then I couldn't, but it didn't matter. By the time I delivered, I was comfortable with like, if I need meds, I'm going to get meds. But my early writing about that was like, no, I'm going to just prove that I have a crazy pain tolerance from all the medical abuse I've endured at this point. I might as well just go for it. And I was afraid. I had some fear that it would turn out that they had been right and I wouldn't be able to deliver the way I, you know, safely and something would happen to me or my baby or whatever. And knowing that I was kind of taking a risk in that regard, but also trusting the doctor I had then instead of, it was a confusing situation. The thing that gave me the most comfort was I was sharing some of that with Brian's cousin and she was like, Alex, bodies can give birth in comas. Like people can deliver babies unconsciously. She was like, whether or not you can do it without pain meds, it doesn't matter. Like you're going to deliver your baby or they're going to do a C-section and bring your baby out of you, but nobody's worried.
I remember hearing that too, that like very same detail and being like, oh, no one ever talked about it that way. I never heard anyone talk about birth that way.
Well, and it also shows like how low the bar is for what we expect of our bodies, right? Like it's comforting to me to hear that an unconscious person can deliver because that's the only thing I can compare myself to.
Yes. Well, and it's also like, I'm just thinking also about like the ignorance of like all of these medical folks just like throwing things out, like they don't even need to double check anything. Like, and thinking like you are actually in the process of participating in writing someone's story of what their life is going to become. You don't even know what you're talking about. Like how much have you, and you don't feel the need to. I'm feeling that a wave of that again. And anger makes a lot of sense.
Does this feel particularly connected to like reproductive health? Like how in what other areas, I'm sure that this has been a reality in other areas of your life, but I wonder how much of it is like amplified.
Yeah, I think disabled people, especially people with uteruses, are regarded in the reproductive world as like we just don't belong there. They don't want to deal with us, I think is what it comes down to. Like there are so few people specializing in disability and reproductive care at all, partly because there's such a bias against disabled people reproducing. Like our society doesn't want us to. I've heard from people that they think it's irresponsible that I've had babies. I mean, idiots on the internet, but there are people who hold those opinions and there have been studies done and surveys done of like the medical profession in general around attitudes regarding people's quality of life and reproduction and things like that. And it's always very unfavorable. So yeah, I think it has a lot to do with reproductive care and like what that field looks like for disabled folks.
I mean, like part of it, and we've been talking about this a lot in the context of like birth and carrying a baby, but I think part of that is also imagining you and me and other disabled parents parenting children once they're out of our bodies and like not believing that that's possible.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, and projected from other disabled mothers all the time. That's another one. My direct messages are very full of disabled parents being like in my direct messages telling me how they must be failing just because they're wheelchair users. And I'm like, but that's, you're just being told that you're not capable of this. You're doing it. Like, there's nothing about what you're doing that's inadequate.
And I think that that gets at this larger idea that we're hoping to like poke at and pull apart in this podcast, which is that just the script of what we imagine when we imagine a parent. What is a parent? What is that job? What does that entail? And disability being this great disruptor to some of the assumptions we have about that, that we don't even often realize that we hold.
I mean, there are so many different systems that have to be deconstructed in your understanding of the world in order for a disabled parent to be like a real, like achievable, for parenting to be achievable for disability, right? Like, we're deconstructing. I love the concept of deconstruction for so many reasons, obviously evangelicalism. But when you can use that model to take apart like old ideas, you can apply it to almost anything, right? And I've gotten to apply it to what like material success looks like. I've gotten to apply it to what does health and fitness look like. It's very different for me as for the average person. So I have to deconstruct what I've been taught. And when we deconstruct what a parent is or what a nuclear family looks like, we get things like non-traditional families with more adults involved in the parenting than usual. And by the way, like I hosted a friend after they had surgery for 2 weeks and they were recovering in my house with my family. We're just all one big family. And they were up in the mornings often helping us make lunches for the kids for their school programs and stuff. And I homeschool. So a lot of the time it was like, I'm also trying to get myself ready to go out with them for stuff. And that person was like, every parent or every family obviously needs at least three parents. How are you guys surviving without another adult in the house? And I'm like, well, that's why we have other adults like in our house all the time. I am so excited that to me, that doesn't feel like a failure. To me, that feels like community. But I know people who need extra support in their house and they see that as a failure of their own abilities because that's what gets projected toward them.
Because somehow living on an island must be better than living with a whole supportive group of other adults.
I just don't buy it. Like, maybe that self-sufficiency and independence feels good to some people. It doesn't feel good to me. I don't want to be alone. Like, I want to have people around me. Better if we can help raise my kids.
Interrupting this episode to say thank you to everyone supporting the podcast on Patreon.
We love seeing your comments come through. We love getting to know each of you better. Like, you being there really means the world to us.
If you want to support the project financially, you can become a paying patron for as low as $5 a month. That's less than a latte.
But there's lots of free ways to support the podcast too. Sharing episodes, giving us one of those very pretty 5-star reviews, all of that makes a huge difference too.
And you can also join Patreon without paying. So the show notes will always be there for you. Okay, back to the show.
We've been talking a lot about like disability focused and like rewriting that script, but like you've done a lot more as a parent in this sort of world that you're building with and for your family that maybe it is related to disability and maybe it isn't. But like, I think we would both love to hear about kind of the new scripts that you're writing in your family or as a family. Like, I love that picture of the whole community. Like, it's not just this one dad and this one mom and we're I don't know, like you have this other way of imagining things and doing things. Would you be able to tell us more about what that looks like and feels like over there?
Yeah, because it's just magical. It's just magical. I usually have somewhere between 4 and 6 kids in my possession.
In my possession.
I'm an adult in charge of a lot of babies. And we just do whatever we want. I was just talking with a friend about this yesterday. Some of it is I require so much help, right? Like, I can't live by myself. I need help. And to be able to reciprocate the kind of help that I get from my friends by caring for their most precious belonging is like this the most fulfilling thing I could possibly do, right? On the flip side of that, learning not to overextend myself and to ask for the help I need and or just accept it and to model offering it and to model setting boundaries, because we're all kind of wading through the same social scripts. It's not like I suddenly found like a group of people who just all know how to do this, right? Like we have to talk about it and model for each other what we need. I posted this in my stories yesterday. I got a call like 2 days ago from my best friend just checking in to say hi. It was on Saturday, and I was trying to get my family ready to go on a cross country trip without me, which they've never done before. I've never not gone on a trip. My family's gone. And so I was super, super stressed out, just knowing I wouldn't be there to like fix the stuff that I messed up if things didn't get packed properly and stuff. And my best friend was like, can I come and get your kids and take them to the pool? And he didn't even have his kids. It was like his day off of parenting his kids. And I was like, it's your day off. Like, I don't want to mess with your time. And he was like, no, shut up. I'll be there in 10 minutes. They were gone for 3 hours. And then they came home. And I mean, there was just like love in the air. My kids felt so cared for by him. And we all made dinner together. And then another friend came over right after the kids went to bed and we hung out. Like, there's this like joy and indulgence in like the company and the friendship that I get to have in addition to, and that we all get to have in addition to the helping and supporting. And I think that's what really drives us forward, is that connect. Because if we're all just like pitching in for the cause, it's like, it's fine. That's rewarding, but it's not as motivating as knowing that like you're about to sink into, like you're going to take your best friend's kids to the pool for 3 hours. And then when you get home, she and her husband are going to have dinner ready for you. And then you're all going to like sink into the couch together and get to like snuggle up and relax. Like, I think it's a way of doing life that a lot of Americans see as kind of juvenile or adolescent. And I don't care.
This was what I found in you, was seeing this like more expansive conversation around intimacy and home building and queerness and like what it was to hold a kid in the midst of all those things. Cause I need a lot of support in really different ways, more about like my mental health, and like I have a high need for solitude and alone time. And there's so many things that made parenting feel like, I don't know if I can do this right, or if it's like really for me, I felt like such a fraud in it. And seeing the way that you were building community and the way that queerness just was like so beautifully woven into your parenting was the thing that was like, oh, okay, I see a thing that I can do. And I was making notes here of this whole thread through this whole conversation has just been like, Rebecca realized that she could have Otto because she saw you, and you finally like understanding that if you hadn't seen someone like you having babies, that would fail to reach. And what like Instagram specifically, I feel like, has given us in being able to see people like us, and that this podcast hopefully would be this like beautiful expansion of that, where we could be seeing so many different versions of what it is to caregive.
And I mean, to that point, like my best friend has terrible anxiety, and like he can't live alone. He can't sleep in a house by himself. And he was describing our dynamic to somebody the other day, and he was basically like, yeah, we're like each other's accommodation buddies. Like, I give her piggyback rides and she crashes at my house when there's no adult around. And like, it's a super reciprocal relationship, but the kinds of support that we're giving each other are quite different. And I have many of those in my life. This is just kind of the one that's like front and center right now, because we're both getting a lot of support.
And that picture that you gave, besides the fact that it's just like, oh, a different option, a different way to do this than we typically always, you know, have depicted. But also it just sounds so much more sustainable and flexible and sturdy. And I love that word indulgence that you used. Like, it's such a perfect word, because it sounds like this ice cream, decadent ice cream treat that you like save for the one special night. But it's like, we get to do that all the time. Why not? Why not just break out the decadent make that the lifestyle. I love that. The joy and indulgence being the framework, like the everyday, the ordinariness of it feels so juicy. And I love that you don't feel like you need to restrict yourself from that or use it like as a little drip, but that you can have like a whole fountain of it.
Yeah. And I mean, some of it is a matter of, it can go too far, right? Like, for example, Brian and I are married and this is my space and this is his space. And what I want isn't always exactly the same thing he wants, right? And so there's also negotiation involved in all of it, which means we have to be intentional. And, you know, I go in spurts where, oops, I just had 3 extra people over here every night for 6 nights in a row. And he's like, I need some space, man. But the indulgence piece of it, I think some of it is also, I don't know, the joy of getting to have those conversations and find out what other people are needing and what works best for everyone. Collaboration and the teamwork and all of it is so fun.
And no assumptions. I mean, I think that it sounds like we are not going to go into this assuming anything about anyone else and that we do need to check in and touch base. And I think that disability and queerness both maybe together are disruptive enough to the status quo that it kind of prompts that constant need to not make assumptions in any direction.
Yes. And I've also gotten really good recently at, like, I'm only making friends intentionally. It's not happening by accident at this age. Like, people don't just make accidental friends for the most part. And I am dating these people. Like, I'm like, hey, do you want to be my friend? What kind of time do you have? What's your communication style like? What are your personal values? And these are questions I'm asking people like in the first 3 or 4 times I like hang out with them. And I'm also talking in those conversations about like, okay, so my life's kind of weird. Like I have really debilitating anxiety and PTSD issues that I'm dealing with right now. Also, I'm in a wheelchair. Like going out with me is not easy. Getting around town is not necessarily easy. You're going to have to trust me that I can safely take care of your kids, or this is going to be a really difficult dynamic for me because I can't be not trusted. And trust me to be able to say when it's not going to work for me, you know? But yeah, there's like lots of creativity and lots of open communication involved in all of it. And one of the things that we kind of are all working together on, and I say all, like there's like a solid little group of 5 or 6 of us. It's not huge. At least locally. I also have this community extended across the country in different ways. But one of the things that we're talking about a lot is learning to love the act of asking for help, because it doesn't work when everyone's always vying to be the helper. And obviously it doesn't work if there's like somebody who just never contributes either. But more often than that, I think I find that people don't ask for help when they should because they feel some kind of stigma around it. And so I kind of get to be like the cute cult leader teaching everyone how to ask for help because I have to all the time anyway. So like for me, some of that indulgent joy is getting to have these like rich, committed relationships outside my like legal marriage, which is the only one we're supposed to have apparently, where we are like actually verbally and with our actions committing to taking care of each other and learning and growing together as a crew. And it's not exclusive. It's not like we're the only people we hang out with or something, but there is like a very close group of people who take really good care of each other. And finding those people and building that together is just like the most joyful thing I've ever done.
I feel like in the stories that I have heard in more like mainstream parenting is that it's like this slog. It's hard. Everyone's like running like crazy. There's never any time. It's just like PTA to this meeting, to this childcare, soccer. And then you're getting to work and there's like no time left for anything. And I feel like the way that we're wanting to build our worlds, and particularly the way that I'm witnessing you build yours, is that there's just so much space in there. I'm so much trying to like divorce myself away from that idea that like, if I'm not like struggling or suffering that like we're not doing enough or it's not real. It's like, how easy can I make everything?
In evangelicalism, I was raised to believe that everything was going to be hard and had to be hard and should be hard. If it wasn't hard, then I was doing it wrong. And that, you know, that indulging in anything that felt good was a sign of like moral weakness and I don't know, just generally failing. And so it is hard to to move yourself away from that. And I still find that coming up for me in other ways, like just because I have this spaciousness. There's so much space and abundance when it comes to the people in my life, like the other adults who are helping me run my life and I'm helping them run theirs. But I do find myself at home, like spiraling about this or that or the other thing not being done and not being able to relax even when all my people are around and I'm enjoying having them here. I got yelled at to get out of my chair and sit down on the couch the other day because I just wouldn't stop like picking at stuff. So that stuff shows up in other ways. And then I've got the accountability, right? I've got the bumpers of a friend who wants me to sit on the couch with her and is like, get the fuck out of your wheelchair, please, right now. And so I think like the chicken and egg thing, when you start building that, the other pieces of those old habits and stuff have to come apart too.
I so appreciate the way that I think this is part of why I loved you right away is just the way that you always are so both and measured and realistic and honest about the layers of everything, you know, like this is beautiful and complicated. This is what the juicy part. This is the rough part. Like I just thank you for showing up that way. I really, really, really is like healing and for me to have the world described in that way.
You know, I like to have my expectations set appropriately. I don't handle disappointment well. Like I'm really bad at disappointment. And so if I can speak in realistic terms, it helps me stay grounded. And I think it also probably does a service to other people who like, if we paint everything as sunshiny and perfect and there's no both and, then other people try it and they're getting the crappy stuff that we're not talking about. And then they think they're doing it wrong or that they're not capable of it or that, I mean, maybe they're just like, well, you must just be full of it, which would be the case if I wasn't being honest about the hard stuff, right? I mean, I can only shift this in my tiny little corner of the world, right? But it's something that can create any kind of ripple effect. It's only going to be done through like total authenticity. There's no like pretending that it's perfect.
Okay, this question Rebecca came up with when we were like interviewing ourselves for the podcast, and I love it so much. When do you feel like the best version of yourself as a parent? Like the parent you want to be when you're in flow state? Paint us a picture.
Oh my gosh, I love loading my minivan up with, I have an 8-passenger minivan, okay? Like, so it could fit me and 7 kids and my wheelchair and my dog. It's the best. And I am the most mobile that I ever am when I'm driving. I don't have to deal with barriers that anyone else isn't dealing with. And so I can scream up to my friend's house in my minivan and like have them freaking Taylor Swift blasting because 8-year-old girls want. And we connect and we sing and we're kind of just all on the same level, and I'm not in a position where I have to like discipline or for the most part, or I just get to play in a way that feels more accessible to me than like any other space I occupy. I've always loved driving. I've always loved being in the car. Road trips are like my favorite thing. And I always feel like my best self on the road. And I try to bring that into my day to day. Like when we get in the car, even if it's been a total nightmare of a morning at my house and everyone's screaming at each other, which does happen like often. and I'm like, my eyes are bulging out of my head and there's steam coming out of my ears. I get in the car and I turn the music on and it's over. Sometimes I have to explicitly apologize and repair for my behavior before I do that. But we repair, we move on, we do karaoke. Arwen takes videos of us all singing along to the same songs. Like Arwen learned how to read in the car because we listened to music with the lyrics turned on my phone screen. And I didn't even do reading phonics stuff with her at all. So it's a really special place for us. I think my next closest to that is when I'm engaged in something that's like giving not just my kids, but other people's kids like life skills. My kids know how to use the kitchen pretty well.
Wasn't Arwen like frying eggs by the time she was like
3? Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh, that's crazy. That's beautiful.
Yeah. And like I said, in that little essay I read at the beginning, I think she is a little more motivated to be independent than the average kid is. But right now I've got 8-year-olds coming over who don't know how to turn on the microwave or like heat up a taquito in the toaster oven. And so I'm teaching them how to do that stuff. And instead of them having to come to me and say, Alex, can I please have a taquito? I can now look at them and say, go get it yourself. I'm not doing it. And like, I think that's my next favorite. And especially when my friends come back to me and are like, holy crap, Alex, they made their breakfast this morning. What did you do? But yeah, probably those two things, giving them skills and being their like fun facilitator when we're kind of doing mundane things are probably my favorites.
How wonderful for all, like, I'm thinking of the kids that are not your like biological kids, getting to learn that from some like safe and fun adult that is not their parents. I don't know. That just sounds so wonderful for everyone involved.
And they're not worried about like, they know that if we break a dish or something here, nobody cares. So the anxiety that they might have around consequences at home, just, you know, parents getting cranky or whatever, they don't exist.
It feels like you really view them as whole people. When I hear you talk about them, that's the gift that I hear you giving them. Even like all the way back to that popcorn story, like how disempowering kind of for the kid to be told like you're capable of this thing and for someone else to swoop in and be like, no, I'll get it for you.
I experience that all the time as a disabled person. I don't want to be perpetrating that.
There's dignity in that.
Dignity, that's what it is.
And honestly, like from my perspective, it's a matter of safety and survival too. Like it's my responsibility to not keep them dependent on me any longer than they need to be. We can have a close connection and attachment, and I can do things for them that they don't need me to do out of love and kindness. And like when I get up early and make all the breakfasts and pack all the lunches without my kids' help and don't ask them for any help, they look at me and say, thanks for doing that, mom. Like, because they know they can do it themselves. Like I, for whatever reason, have been getting up early. I'm not an early morning person. And that's one of the reasons it's been important for my kids to learn how to make breakfast. Because I like that's just one thing I can't push myself through. And I'm a bad parent if I try. So I sleep later than the average, or I stay in bed later than the average full-time stay-at-home parent, I think. And one of the ways I manage that is I put in some work at the beginning and got up early and taught them how to make breakfast. And now I don't have to. But when I do, now they say thank you because they know they're capable of it. And they know the expectation is that they take care of that themselves. And it feels like a gift. And it feels like sweet caregiving when I do it for them, as opposed to just like they're entitled to have someone else do this thing for them that they could be doing.
This is what I think of when I say things like disability forces me to be the parent I want to be, because I do think that, I mean, not in every way, I'm sure, but like in a lot of ways, I do think that I like to feel needed and being able to be like, oh, here, sweetie, here's the popcorn. Like, I like being able to feel like you're a little dependent on me. And I think that if I could do that until Otto was 30, I might accidentally do that. But like to feel like there's this strain where there is this force necessitating him learning to do some of that himself feels like I'm really glad that he has that set up, because I think I might sabotage the whole thing if I could, and I can't. At least that part of it, I can't sabotage.
Yeah. I mean, my limitations, your limitations, like make us creative. And if they force us to do things in ways we wouldn't otherwise. Last night, I stayed at a friend's house. And because again, my family's out of town and I don't like being alone. So I stayed at a friend's house. My dog was home here in his crate. And I was like, I'm too tired to go get him. Will you go get him for me? This friend lives very close. And so my friend came and got him. And I had to send him a text message with the instructions, like, I need this object from this spot and this object from this spot and this object from this spot. And this is how you get his harness on him. And he got back from picking Sully up and was like, holy crap, you know how to use your words. And he reflected back like what it must be like to not be able to do things myself physically and to have to instruct other people. Like I have to know where the entire inventory of every belonging I own is in case I can't get to it myself and need to tell someone how to get it. And when you apply that to parenting, your kids are getting so much more of like a creative experience. They're learning, like my kids can follow instructions. They can read maps. They can look at diagrams. They can do to-do lists because I have to do that stuff with them.
I love that you know how to use your words, because the flip side of that is like parents always telling their kids, use your words, right? Like you're modeling that for them. They get to experience that with you. Yeah, that's really cool. Should we ask our final question, Caitlin?
The thing that we want to know is, this is something that I'm constantly working through, especially since having Charlie, is like, what are the nuggets? What are the things that I'm carrying with me from my childhood that I want to pass down? And what are the things that I'm releasing that I'm scratching out? What's the new script I'm making?
So I have a really complicated relationship with, for sure, my dad, or no relationship at this point, which I'm happy to say, and not happy to be the truth, but happy to be honest about it. My relationship with my mom is overall positive and also complicated. And I'm still able to reflect on even my dad, like things that he kind of imbued that I've hung on to, that I'm really trying to teach my kids. One of these things that I'm trying to bring into our family is when you're feeling like you are in some kind of like deficit, or your self-esteem is low, or you're not feeling good about who you are as a person, the best thing to do is like focus outward on the needs of the people you love, because that will bring perspective to the like your own importance in those relationships. It's going to meet that need for self-love. My mom is one of the most creative people I know. She, like, for as difficult as parenting young kids was for her, especially in the dynamic she was in with my dad, she channeled like all of her stuff into creating. So she's a seamstress. She like made my wedding dress. She used to do like entire bridal parties. She also did these amazing Halloween costumes for us every year. And my memories of time with my mom were, she didn't play. She wasn't like a mom that played games with kids or something. She sewed, and she would sit me on the floor on her cardboard cutting board and give me a pen, and I would like color in the grid on the cutting board, like doodle on it while she used it for sewing. And I was never bored, and it was when I felt like my mom was the most present with me. So one of the things I try to do is make sure that there isn't like division between like, this is an adult creative practice, or we do have just adult time, obviously, but it's usually when the kids are in bed, like when they couldn't participate. Drawing the kids into the things that feel good to me and bring me joy, and sharing that with them without any expectation that they're going to be that into it, and without facilitating necessarily their participation, just inviting them to be with me, has given me ways to connect with my kids that I wouldn't have otherwise. Because I'm also not super into playing. That's one of the reasons driving in the car and singing and stuff is fun for me. I don't particularly like to get on the floor and play cars.
Does anyone?
I don't know. I mean, I think there are parents that do, but it's not me. And I guess so those two things, like bringing those into my family, have been really valuable. The focus outward, get out of your own head as much as you can, but in ways that serve your wellness. And then sharing the creative interests and things with my kids in ways that are kind of neutral without expectation. I think things that I'm releasing and letting go of are like, I mean, perfectionism is so huge in evangelicalism. Like the purity culture thing extends to everything, including like how clean your house is and how healthy your meals are. It can, depending on the part of the country you're in. Like, you know, the purity testing everything all the time has been a real struggle for me. I panic when my house is messy because my house had to look like a museum when I was a kid. And letting some of that go, getting comfortable with things like dishes breaking and actually just like cackling about it. We're just laughing when a dish breaks now. We're not screaming at anyone. Making a home a place where people feel safe to rejuvenate and be themselves, that was not my house as a kid. And so letting go of all of those things that I think my parents thought would make the house feel the way they wanted it to. And then I internalized that, and Brian has had to really help me let go of a lot of that stuff. I think another one is demanding black and white perfection when it comes to honesty from my family members. Like perfect, honest, accurate disclosure of like every mistake they've made, every way that they've like failed and need to be held accountable. That was really big in my world. Often you like were expected to do it voluntarily, and it could be really humiliating. And then you have to deal with consequences for who knows how long and how many contexts, right? And so focusing on like who we are, who we know we are in our like as people, and going like, okay, that was a mistake. I'm really, really not happy about that situation that just happened, but I'm not going to like beat you over the head over it forever or hold your feet to the fire to the point that you're suffering and I'm not getting anything useful out of it. And I'm not good at that one, by the way. Like when my kids disappoint me, I want them to know it. And I go way too far to like point out each individual thing they should have disclosed or they should have done differently. And that's something that I'm actively working to deconstruct at this point.
I just started taking notes at the end of things that I'm like, I want to do this and think about this. And those are like all just a string of nuggets.
It was like a long string too. Sorry.
So cool and helpful to think about. And a lot of that I had not really thought of before. I had never really thought about purity culture applying in all of these other spaces. I never thought of it that way, but that makes sense and resonates.
I'm like, just you wouldn't recognize me like physically, spiritually, emotionally in any way from like right before I had kids, probably. It's been kind of a slow change. But if you were to just look at like day one of me being a parent and now, and a lot of that has been understanding the tendrils of evangelicalism and like where it has held on real tight a little at a time. And I feel like about once a month, I'm like, oh, it's in there too? Come on. And I look out the vacuum cleaner and figure out how to get it out. And, you know, old habits are super hard to break and I have to ask for help. And also I surround myself with people who weren't raised the way I was. I have some, that's important too for relating, but a lot of the people that spend the most time in my house, just like they don't even understand what that is. They're like, we're raised by like dirty hippies. And so it's, I get accountability in that because they think it's like absurd. Like, I get to have like loving correction from people who are like, what are you doing to yourself? This is not necessary.
That sounds very cathartic. Someone being like, that has no power here.
It is. And I get that pretty often. So, and I give it to them pretty often too. So it's really cool. Yeah.
Alex, I feel like we're very lucky that you were up for being the very first person that we would interview. This was the best. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for being here with us and talking about all these things that are personal and you're in it. And so thank you for like being honest about all these things as they're unfolding in real time, as well as the stuff from the past and the world you're making in the future. And we love you so much.
I want to come back someday. This was really fun to do it again.
Where can the people find you, Alex?
Right now, it's just Instagram at Alex Wegman, AlexWegman. I am working on some exciting stuff that I will share about there eventually. So if you want to know how to get that exciting stuff, follow me on Instagram.
Oh, and hopefully when that exciting stuff comes, you could come back on and we could talk all about it.
Super applicable to all of this. So yes, it's a cute little sidekick to all of this. Yeah.
Yay.
Yay.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You tell me when we're done, okay?
This podcast is edited and perfected by Amelia of Softer Sounds.
For all the show notes and a transcript of today's episode, check out our Patreon, Scratch That Podcast. This is our hub. It's where you can join the conversation and be part of our community.
If today's episode resonated with you or made you think of someone, share it.
And if you want to support the pod and also make us glow inside, go give a 5-star review on Apple. That would be so lovely.
Thank you for being here, for listening, for being a part of this community.
We love you so much.